everybody, and a very warm welcome to today's seminar hosted by the International Inequalities Institute at LSC. My name is Shalini Grover, and I'm an anthropologist and a research fellow. I'm incredibly pleased to be chairing today's seminar titled Mobilizing Productive Subjectivities, Transnational Production, and Social Reproduction in Unequal Europe, which is part of the IAI's Inequality Seminar Series. Today's speaker is Dr. Anya Plomin, and she's an associate professor at LSE's Department of Gender Studies. She's also a very active faculty associate at the IAI and has lent a very strong and encouraging voice to our global economies of care theme. So a very warm welcome, Anya, and thank you for accepting our invitation. Anya's research is really fascinating. She focuses on micro and macro level socioeconomic processes, shaping complex gender inequalities through activities related to social reproduction, care, employment, transnational labor mobility, and the policies that affect them. She also examines these dynamics in contemporary Europe, which is quite rare because a lot of this is, you know, global care chain, social reproduction is always associated with the global South. And she looks at these developments at national and supranational governance levels, as well as transnationally. So during this hybrid event, may I ask the audience to keep yourself muted and have your videos on wherever possible. And there'll be a chance for you to pose your questions later, and we'll take questions both in person and online in a particular pattern. The next event, which I hope many of you will attend, is titled Challenges Facing Liberal Democracies, Citizenship and Civil Society Confronting Gender Inequality, and it'll take place at 12:30 next Tuesday, 18th October. Before I hand you over to Anya, I'd also like to thank Peter and Emma and the IAI for always being there for us and for their support. So over to you, Anya, and thank you so much again.
Well, thank you so much to Shalini, to Peter, to Emma, and to the II for allowing me to share this research with you today. This work, can you hear me okay? Is it, this is, I've been warned about this temperamental. So this is collaborative research with Dr. Gregory Schwartz at the University of Bristol. And this is an ongoing work that we started just before the onset of the pandemic and have been carrying it out in bits and drafts throughout the pandemic. And it looks at questions of transnational labor mobility within Europe, so within the EU, but also outside of the European Union, countries in Europe, with a focus on questions of capitalist production and social reproduction and how they play out in this uneven geopolitical space. And researches with Ukrainian and Polish migrant, transnational migrant workers who have, over the last few years, in great numbers, sought better fortunes, better lives in different countries of destination. For Polish workers, it is Germany and the UK. For Ukrainian workers, it is predominantly Poland. And in this paper, we are focusing on the lived experiences of laboring subjectivities of these workers that we have spoken to as they confront the necessities of provisioning for their social reproduction. And we do this in three fields of life: care, shelter, and food production. And so what I'd like to do today is to first introduce to you what the project is about, the basic contours of it, and a couple of analytical frames that we are trying to deploy to make sense of the productive subjectivities of the labor migrants that we have talked to, and reaching preliminary conclusions. This is the analysis for this project is still ongoing. So this is emerging findings. In terms of the project, we're looking at the transnational mobile workers, Polish and Ukrainian workers, who have moved to Poland, to the UK, and to Germany. And they are working in these sectors of care provision, food production, and housing constructions. And the stages and levels of analysis are twofold. At the first stage, we have looked at the macro and long-term political and economic developments that are relevant to stage transformations, market transformations, and changes within households in Poland and in Ukraine as countries of origin, and to some extent in the countries of destination, which contribute to these interconnected mobilities of labor. And so far we've done interviews with 39 individuals, with Polish and Ukrainian workers, and 21 Ukrainians and 18 Polish. We have done the interviews up to the end of last year. So we have not spoken to Ukrainian people who have left Ukraine since the most recent expansion, amplification of Russia's invasion on Ukraine. We have roughly spoken to half and half men and women, and 10 of them are working in care sectors, 13 in housing construction, and 14 in food production. One of them is also working in a migrant work agency, and another one runs a migrant community organization. So why did we look at these countries, and why did we look at these migrant workers? What struck us was the sheer volume of migration and transnational labor mobility that was less permanent. This graph is showing the arrivals and the number of Polish people in the UK in thousands. And it shows that Polish migration to the UK peaked at more than 900,000 in 2017. Roughly, it was divided half and half between men and women. At the same time as large numbers of Polish people were leaving Poland to the UK and to Germany, there were a huge number of Ukrainian workers coming to Poland. And this is a graph that illustrates the employer's declarations to hire a Ukrainian worker in Poland. There is a break in series because of different collection methods of the data. And these numbers show the actual numbers of workers who have been hired by a Polish employer, but they do not include seasonal jobs. And so the numbers are still likely to be higher. So at any given time, there are about 1.5 million Ukrainian workers in Poland. The numbers of men are much higher than of women, and I am not capturing here the situation after 2021. And so you see, in the case of Ukrainians arriving in Poland, we have a rise of migration into Poland, not because this has become a new thing for Ukrainian workers, but because Ukrainian workers has shifted the direction of travel from migrating to Russia towards Western and East European countries. In case of the Polish workers who have been coming to Britain, but also to Germany, from 2004 onwards, there has been a steady rise. And then you see the impact of Brexit from 2016, where we have falling numbers of Polish workers in the UK. Here is another map that I borrowed from the internet that shows the European labels for different countries in Europe by the top nationality from outside that nation. So in Poland, the top nationality is Ukraine. In Germany, Polish people comprise the highest proportion of foreign-born workers. And in the UK, it's currently India. These numbers are for 2019, but up to the peak of 2017, Polish nationals were in that top position. And so Poland, Germany, and the UK and Ukraine are linked through various mobilities of workers, and some of them are interlinked. For example, Polish nurses working in Poland and Polish nurses working in Germany and in the UK are replaced in large numbers by Ukrainian workers working in Poland, likewise with people working in food production sectors and in housing construction. And so what is the context for these large numbers of people leaving? This has been a development of about three decades in the making, with the demise of state socialism and the integration of these economies into the global economy since 1989 in 1992. And the context for this integration has been global change in the world of work. And so trade liberalization, multilateral governance, deregulation, fiscal deregulation, and market flexibility have been quite heavily pursued in Poland as well as in Ukraine, but there have been some differences between these countries. And so Poland and Ukraine are relatively large European states. The population in Poland is 38 million, in Ukraine it is 44 million. And in 2020, their GDP per capita and purchasing power parity was 33,000 in Poland, which is lower than European average of 37,000. And it was 13,000 in Ukraine, which is the second lowest out of European countries. Both countries have undergone through deindustrialization. So the heavy industry was reformed and structured. But in Poland, this was mainly a foreign direct investment led initiative. In Ukraine, oligarchs led processes took the country in a different direction. So restructuring, skill development has taken place in Poland, still a skill deterioration and disintegration of production took place in Ukraine, just roughly speaking. These processes meant that in Poland we have relatively still low wages, but quite a high level of skill that is attractive to companies to come into Poland, but as well as a veil of Polish workers who are willing to migrate. In Ukraine, the situation, especially since 2014, has been much more difficult in terms of regularity of wages. There has been a development of low value services and quite a lot of informalization of employment. So high irregularity and informalization. There has also been a retrenchment or recalibration of the welfare state in both places. In Poland, there has been some drive towards marketization and social investment type of issues. And in Ukraine, some more significant processes of retrenchment as well as recalibration with economic crisis as well as conditionality imposed by international institutions, making it much more difficult to provide in the public sector. And so both countries have experienced quite high labor mobilities, where workers had weak voice and exercised their exit options. So for Polish workers, the opening of EU markets has proved a catalyst. Polish workers have been to a great extent mobile already, but opening up of EU markets and giving them in many countries similar rights, citizenship rights, mobility rights has been the catalyst. And high labor mobility and shift from Russia to Poland was the case for Ukrainian workers, and the Polish government experiencing huge labor gaps has opened up its labor market quite liberally to Ukrainian workers who were coming on 3, 6, or 9 month visas. And that was for particular sectors and industries. And so we're focusing on our analysis, our research on three sectors of production and social reproduction. We're looking at care and food and housing and the ways in which these spheres intersect paid and unpaid economies. Food, care and shelter are central to social provisioning. They are the stuff that life is made of. Without care, food and shelter, we would not be able to sustain individuals, communities, societies. And these sectors of activities, of human activities, have been differentially commodified and differentially gendered. And so in housing construction, the majority of the effort is being conducted through paid employment, whereas with care provision, while you have greater commodification, the majority of care still takes place on an unpaid basis. These sectors are also differentially gendered, with care being highly feminized and food is quite mixed, food production and housing construction is a masculinized form of labor. And these sectors have also been subject to the similar pressures over the last few decades to increasing productivity and questions of profitability. And so there has been sector growth in all these domains. Care is supposed to be one of the most highly growing sectors when it comes to paid employment and has been for some time. And they have been incorporated into market competition in similar ways that other sectors, but the ability to realize profit in some of these activities is more difficult than in other sectors of production because demand for this labor could be local. So for example, with the spatial fixes that David Harvey talks about in terms of offshoring, when you think about caring labor, it's unlikely that you would be shipping your parents, elderly parents or grandparents off to Ukraine or the Philippines for care. And so there are certain dynamics that make provisioning in place essential in these sectors. With housing renovation and constructions, and with food production, all these, there is an element of local subsistence, and not these are not so easily substitutable, and location sensitivity is a key element of this. With care, especially, there is a relational component to this as well. It matters who provides the care that's being received. And so there are significant shortages in all these sectors and across European countries. We have shortages in Poland, in Ukraine, as we do in Germany and in the UK for that kind of labor. And the shortages are a consequence of growth. So there is a greater demand for workers, workers participating, producing in these activities. But also there is some demand specificity where you have local workers who could perform these jobs, but for some reason they are either unavailable or unwilling to perform them. And that takes us to the two components of the analytical sort of analytical manner in which we try to unpack what's going on in contemporary Europe. One of them is that question or the analytical lens of social reproduction. Social reproduction is typically framed as either a daily or an intergenerational reproduction of the labor of the workforce. And we look at social reproduction as it extends beyond the paid and unpaid care and household production. So social reproduction often is made synonymous with care. And we think that social reproduction, all these activities that allow people to show up at work today and in the next generation, rely on also on wages and on market substitutes and on public provision, as well as household production and domestic work. So to us, it is the state, the market, and the household that form the nexus of reproducing society. And this also takes place transnationally, where market states and households participate in this process at the transnational level. And so social reproduction is interdependent with capitalist production. It is a necessary and a contradictory relationship with social Marxist feminists have argued several decades ago. And the crisis tendencies in production, the processes of neoliberalization, have impacted on people's ability to self-reproduce. And so neoliberalization that I alluded to in the context of Poland and Ukraine also affected these domains of markets with falling wages, precarization and formality, the state in terms of services being commodified, and there has been a greater conditionality. There has been some disinvestment in areas, in other areas there has been investment. And at the household level, the collective time and money resources, the mix has changed where wage-oriented labor is going up, but state support has been going down. And so in this context, we see labor migration as being part of this production-reproduction nexus, where workers respond to the pressures on social reproduction and opt to move. And the second element is how we then engage with our participants' interests and their experiences of their life, of their transnational life. And we probe the multiple truths that are meaningful to them, the multiple rationalities that they share, as a particular experience. We draw on feminist standpoint theory, where we pay attention to the perspectives on social reproduction, on the social reality of social reproduction of these participants. And these experiences contribute to the formation of the subject formation of our workers. But we go beyond that. We try to go beyond that subject formation at the level of what participants understand and how they are making sense. And we try to combine this with the analysis of a historically variable context, how the personal and the social are imbricated in one another, drawing on John Scott. And finally, we hope to develop this element of this paper by drawing and operationalizing Guido Starosta's concept of productive subjectivity. And we try to focus on how migration and work, the experiences and the wider social processes come to represent productive subjectivities. Starosta, in the concept of productive subjectivities, notes that there is a growing differentiation of what he calls in the productive attributes of the collective laborer. So he looks at the workforce, the collective laborer, and saying this is being an increasingly differentiated process where workers are historically and spatially produced, and there is an internal polarization within the global, the collective laborer. And this is in line with the productive attributes of its members. So habituation to intensive, cheaper, more arduous work would be one element of this, the harsher conditions. And so we're trying to understand how both the migrant workers are making sense of their conditions, but also how that then leads to materialization of labor or of welfare inequality in our context. And so I have some quotes from our participants. I promised no equations today. I hope you are not disappointed. But this is a quote from focusing on the necessities of provisioning, necessities of gaining the kind of material and time and state resources through the market, through the welfare state, through communities that allow people to provision for themselves. This is a quote from Vasil, who is a Ukrainian construction worker working in Poland. And Vasil is sharing his narration of how he comes from a rural area where he did not get regular pay. And he talks about this is still quite a significant element taking place, that there is constant delaying or not paying of wages. You just don't get it here. In Poland, you don't get it. And in the village that where he comes from, there are so many who don't get paid even for 3 months. And here it's regular. You get paid on the 8th, and if not on the 8th, then on the 9th, and there in Ukraine, they delay. This was one of the reasons why he left seeking jobs elsewhere. And he first, before coming to Poland, he went to Lithuania. And there he had a health episode. He had a stroke and he needed urgent treatment. But there was something wrong with his insurance policy. And so he was responsible for paying something like 25,000 euros for his treatment. For a Ukrainian worker who has not been earning regular wages and is now a transnational migrant worker who has to support his family, that was a lot of money. The problem with insurance didn't get sorted. The state didn't come in with help either. And so his then next stint abroad, now working in Poland, is to pay off this huge debt, the thousands of euros that he owes. And so he works for that and for his family. Another example is from Agata, Agatha was a pediatric nurse and she loved this job, but the issue was pay again. And after graduation, we had to pay premiums. And then they started these new contracts in healthcare. So suddenly wages dropped and there was so little you could do with this money. I always joke that it was the 1500 zlotys generation. No matter what degree you got, you were getting paid 1500 zlotys. So I realized I have to look for something else. I did not believe these big adverts that a nurse abroad earns 20,000 zlotys. Unfortunately, people don't talk about the costs of living being so much more, at least 5,000 for a room. Necessity of provisioning relates to people who had struggled finding housing and with having a small child thought that going from Ukraine to Poland would allow them to build a house. Here's an example from Jarek, who is a construction worker in the UK. And he talks about his friend. Jarek is a builder in his 50s, has worked in the UK for 13 years. The first 5 years was traveling back and forth between Poland and the UK. And some of his friends still do that. There were eight of them living in the same house, sharing a house with five rooms. And so Jarek talks about how his friend, he's been carrying on like this for the last 13 years. He tried to move back once. He was there for 6 months and all his savings ran out. They also built their own house. After half a year, he just couldn't find himself and returned to England. It's all about wages. I don't have to worry that I won't have enough money like I was in Poland. Every time I got paid, I was worried there that after having paid bills, how much will I have left until the first? Will it be enough? Here, I don't have that feeling. I just earn my money and it's enough for whatever I need. I don't deny myself anything. England is beautiful. You can travel. Such an old country. You like the old churches, castles, mountains, and there's plenty of this here, so we can enjoy it. But Jarek works 6 days a week, 9 hours Monday to Friday, and 6 hours on Saturdays. And he also says that if I need the money, I'll work on Sundays too. And so this kind of necessities of provisioning, having to leave, don't necessarily match up with this idea of having the time to enjoy this old country. Anita, the wife of Jarek, who was also there during the interview, I asked her, so when your husband was here in the UK the first 5 years, how did you manage over there? And she said, well, we had to. In fact, the whole house was on my shoulders because my husband went away as we were finalizing the construction of the house. But we still had to do this and that. Finish the interiors, and I was left in charge of it all. Our son was helping a bit, but he was still in school. And my mother was sick. She had Alzheimer's. She needed 24/7 care. So I had to look after her, which is also why I did not come to see Jarek here in the UK on a vacation at all. And they still feel not quite at home here. Find that they will never be accepted fully as ourselves. There are families there, mother, son, the whole family's there, my brother, our lifelong friends are there. We have friends here too, but they are kind of acquired over 5 or 6 years. And there, it's our whole life center. In terms of how some of the improvements that workers have been able to make, there is a sense, sometimes it is more acute, sometimes less, that they improve their own social reproduction conditions by deferring their social reproduction needs. And so Daria, for example, who works in a farm in Poland, and lives in this building, talked about how her and her coworkers live in a converted farm office building, three or four or five women or men per room, and there is a shared kitchen. Bathroom and laundry facilities are also shared. And we pay rent to the company. It's at a lower rate than something similar on the free market, not to speak of apartments available in town. So the possibility of having a sort of independent and fully flourishing living conditions is deferred for at some point in the future. For Ina, who was a carer in Poland, she talks about the long working hours. We work 12-hour days, starting at 7 a.m., nonstop, the whole day, every day, no difference. Weekdays, weekends, I had little time for anything, some shopping, that's all. Every hour there was some task, moving from one to another. I looked after many women, feeding, making beds, organizing clothes, washing them, grooming them, feeding, washing again, all day, nonstop. It's not like at home where I can stop or do something now or later or differently. It was constant. I don't have much time left, so I'll mention a question of productive subjectivities related to questions of migration. And so here are some examples from Anatoly, who is an agricultural student in Ukraine and was coming to Germany for a few months at a time, combining studies and this kind of migrant work. And he talked about how many migrants are not willing to emigrate or even move from villages to town, to cities. People love where they're from, the vegetable patches. I'm more of a risk taker. I'm young, I don't have responsibilities. I want to use my time while at college to make money, gain experience, skills, have a job. It's not some kind of an ideal job being in Germany, but it doesn't matter that I am a migrant. I can use it as a kind of self-improvement, a new experience. I can say I worked in Germany, which will be valuable in Ukraine. For Kirill, he understands that there is a differentiation for wages of Ukrainian construction workers in Poland. And he compares his situation to the Poles who have left for Germany or are still there working. He talks about how Poles have left for better pay in Germany. And we, Ukrainians, come here because pay here is higher for us and the labor market is bigger. You can find a job. I suspect that there might be differences in pay, that we might get less. You know how it is. A Pole is working in his home and I came here just to make money. Some might say that you come here to rob them of their jobs. I never met anybody saying this, but from what I've heard, it happens. But at this job, we don't have things like that. And Vitol, a farm worker in the UK, talks about how there is a distinction and how employers differentiate between migrant and non-migrant workers working on the farm. He said how the owner tried to hire locals. This lasted maximum 3 months. It took 8 people to do the job of normally done by 3 migrants. In the end, my boss started to realize that he should respect migrants' work better. We now have mostly Poles, Bulgarians, Romanians. And so these stories come up over and over again. Long working hours, short time to oneself on the weekend, on a Sunday. And differentiated conditions from the local workforce. So here Daria talks about these and talks about how some of our tasks are worse than what the Poles do. It is tough standing 12 hours washing leeks in cold water. So I'm cold. My hands and my feet are cold, but I'm used to it. And the managers, they're used to me. Everything they ask me to do, I do. Daria goes there, do this and do that. And they know that I will do everything the best I can. And Ursula, a carer in the UK, a similar situation, very flexible and available to the employer. who has a 36-hour contract but frequently works over 50 and knows exactly how many hours per month she works. But she's proud of the fact that she is available, that she is wanted when she is being told, "We need workers like you. You know, we're very happy that you are with us." She says that she has this big grin on her face. So towards finalizing this initial foray into our data, one more example from Agata, who talks about the qualities of Polish nurses, but does it with a bit more of a cynical distance to the patients that she is interacting with. And she noticed, you know, when they ask her, "Where are you from?" I say, "Poland." And they say, "I hope you will not go back because we have shortages." And I laugh that we also in Poland have shortages. "But we need you more here," they laugh like that sometimes. You can see that they don't want to. They don't want to lose their nurses. And maybe it will be harder for us with Brexit. They are so smart. They would like to keep migration to specific occupations, those they need. And they know that nurses from Poland are so family friendly. We know how to work hard. And then a nurse from Poland has a good opinion that she can create something out of nothing. And so this is my last selection. Looking at or thinking through some of this material through the productive subjectivities, and so the value of the labor power of these workers, they usually don't make, none of them have made any claims on the state to improve their social reproduction needs. I apologize for the typo there. And their improvement of social reproduction is done only in a patchy way. So they manage to attain either better housing or better income conditions, but it always comes with some kind of a cost. Gains are based on deferring more flourishing levels of welfare for themselves and for the families. And it's difficult to know whether it is positive or negative on balance. So some people have realized various housing projects, which they wouldn't have realized if they didn't come to the UK or to Ukraine, from Ukraine to Poland. But others endure these material hardships and have experienced family breakdown and breakdown of family relationships with spouses and children. And so they do not make claims on the state, but invest in their mobile labor and entrepreneurship projects. That's the type, I apologize. They perceive the differentiation in the workplace unevenly, where there is either an acceptance of different working conditions or they are working with the differentiations to gain some kind of advantage. And so transnational labor mobility in these sectors by these workers solidifies the obligation of the state in social reproduction in terms of insufficient provisioning through public resourcing. And in country of origin, and because securing wages abroad makes up for the state non-provisioning, but also in countries of destination, as local workers are resorted to cheapen the production of goods and services that we local workers then consume. And so again, there is a making up of the state non-provisioning. And there is a reconfiguration of labor by entrenching differentiation in labor conditions in labor markets. So migrants are needed as migrants rather than as workers and citizens in the host, in the recipient communities. I would also, okay, thank you.
Thank you, Anya. That was totally fascinating. And the narratives were so beautifully, you know, the way you contextualized it and the way you put social reproduction in its context of state, market, household, and you've shown the inequalities in Europe and how the UK has avoided an egalitarian conversation on care by just giving it to migrants and commodifying this labor. So please sit down and take a breath and we engage in a conversation now. So we're going to do in-person asking Anya and online we'll kind of alternate. So while asking, please state your name and maybe your department, some affiliation, so we know who you are. So I open the floor for the Q&A.
Thank you, Anya. I'm Armina Ishpanian. I am the Executive Director of the Atlantic Fellows for Social and Economic Equity Program at the III. Really interesting talk. One of the things that struck me was that you talked about the state, the market, and the household. And as someone who studies civil society or the third sector, I was thinking, well, where is that? Particularly in the context of neoliberalism, where you have a shrinking state and the third sector, nonprofit sector, civil society is meant to step in. So I was, you know, part of that question is, do you see these community organizations or mutual aid societies or things like that stepping in also to fill in these absent welfare needs that are not being met by the state and perhaps the household? The second question is, you know, within civil society, trade unions, right, who are part of civil society, often, and there's a literature on this, that, you know, when trade union activity is strong, you see workers' rights being defended. But this is a very complex context in the sense that you're dealing with migrant workers. So, you know, are they, I mean, I guess they would have rights in the sense of, you know, being there legally, right? But how are they engaging, or if they are engaging? And you know, perhaps the labor unions don't even want anything to do with them because they're driving down wages for local workers. So it's a question that comes from civil society, but in two different threads.
Should I answer?
Sure, yes.
Okay, thank you. So I think when you couldn't avoid civil society, if you look at today's Britain and food banks, right? So that's one prime example how community organizing and community push and pull is very present. When you look at the combination of housing construction, care provision, and food production, so just specifically zooming in on these sectors and dimensions, the civil society, you know, our communities have suffered like the households as well. So it is a reallocation of resources, and time for civic participation and activities has been affected as well. So through our material, so I think analytically, yes, there is definitely space for society, right, of our politicians reframing it every 5 minutes they change in this government. But currently, when it comes to migration, they have facilitated migration to a great extent. Okay. But there is this strange sort of overlap with market and civil society, households and civil society. When you look at civil society organizations, often they are quite professional and marketized in terms of helping migrants as well. So I think it's a tricky question to just quickly answer. Yeah. But yes, there is space for theorizing and looking into this space. And in terms of trade unions activity, and that's an interesting thing from the point of view of both Poland and Ukraine and workers organizing and workers power, because during the demise or the fall of state socialism, we've had hugely powerful workers organizing and wanting to improve the conditions of social reproduction, but they have looked towards the market as part and parcel of the political freedoms and the cultural freedoms that they didn't have during state socialism. And that happened at the time where workers in Western Europe were under attack. And so from a certain position of strength entering that space, the situation of trade unions in Poland, for example, has been falling quite significantly over the years. But you have also alternative trade union organizing migrant workers in the UK. None of our respondents have belonged to an organized union.
I mean, I was interested because, you know, obviously Solidarność in Poland was, it led to, you know, all of those changes happening in the 80s. But anyway, thank you so much.
We do have a question from Alpa. Alpa, can you come online?
Hi, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, lovely to hear from you. Alpa is a professor of anthropology and also our team leader. So go ahead, Alpa.
Thanks so much, Shalini. Thanks, Anya. That was fascinating. Much of what you said is so resonant of some of the themes that Jens Lerker and I have been working on in relation to labor migration and social reproduction production in India. And one of the things that we really kind of grappled with, and I just wanted to make a suggestion to you based on our own debates, is to more carefully perhaps conceptually differentiate between people working in the care economy and social reproduction as a concept. And I felt that there's a kind of analytical slippage going on in your paper, especially in the first half, where you're kind of using both terms interchangeably, and that actually separating these concepts actually makes it would make for a more powerful analysis in the longer run. So just to kind of explain what I want to say is that, so the people that you have interviewed, at least to me, are working in either the care economy as nurses or as care workers, or you include also food provision and you include construction, housing industry, right? But behind that lies their own social reproduction, which is not counted, which is not remunerated, however badly they're remunerated in their care economies and food production or in the housing sector. There is behind that a whole process of social reproduction of their own households and communities, which is not remunerated at all. And I think that this distinction needs to be separated in order to more powerfully analyze their work in those sectors. And if you do that, then I wanted to ask you a question about how are these different sectors different in relation to social reproduction and care and the care economy? Because presumably, you know, the construction workers are mainly male, and presumably, if you look within their households, you will have women who may or may not be working, but may be working in the care sector. I mean, it's common knowledge that, you know, in the UK, Polish construction workers, their wives are often working as cleaners, as nurses in the care economy. So there's a more in the houses where both people are working in the paid sector, there is a crisis, a further crisis in social reproduction, which is not accounted for formally. So I just think that there is, because of this slippage, I was unclear about, you know, how you're using these terms, care, the care economy and social reproduction, and how they map differently in relation to the three sectors you're thinking about. Yeah, I understand this is work in progress, and so these are just suggestions. You may not have responses right now, of course.
Thank you, Alpa. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, perfectly. Yeah,
great. Okay, so thanks. Yes, in the written version of it, the distinctions are much more tidy, and certainly, yes, we are aware of a lot of the social reproduction literature talking about care, the care economy, or the households. And we were intentionally trying to broaden it out to think about social reproduction as something that requires all these different inputs that include inputs from the market, that include inputs from the state and from the household. And so it is, rather than care provisioning at home, which is unpaid, or care provisioning, which is outsourced, or the care economy, which is more formal, either in the public or the private sectors. So I will bear the kind of caution there in mind to make this always clear. And yes, that connects to your second point. The couple that I have interviewed, Jarek and I think Anita, Aga. There was Agata as well. See, I remember their real names, not the pseudonyms. So it's a little tricky. And so it's precisely the case that he is a builder working in the UK for 13 years, mm-hmm. and then she was initially providing care for her mother with Alzheimer's in Poland, and then we joined him here. And they lived together, having to cobble a living together with seven other workers in the same house. And until she found the cleaning job in town, they were able to improve the conditions for their own more flourishing social reproduction, so to say. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, these are interesting entanglements, which might be a good way to take the paper forward as well. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Alpa. So I'll move on to the audience again. Any more questions?
All right, thanks for the presentation. I have two very, very basic, possibly surprising for how basic they are questions. The first one is, how the process of selection of the interviewee, what were the criteria that you followed? And the second, in all the narrative, I didn't see much about children. So do they have children? Who takes care of them? So why you decided not to talk about this in the presentation? Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Yes, selection criteria. So we focused on the two broad groups of Polish and of Ukrainian migrants for the reasons that I specified, but specifically, it was just trying to find people. Migrants are inherently difficult to reach working in these industries. We started this work in 2019, and then 2020-21, things went difficult when it comes to being able to actually meet with people face to face. So there has been a focus on people who have moved from Ukraine to Poland and worked in these sectors, people who have moved from Poland to Germany or to the UK. It's largely in the UK, and worked in these sectors. And it was by visiting farms, by visiting building sites, by putting adverts in different migrant media, migrant organizations. And so it has been quite a laborious process of selecting these people. The majority of them have children. Some of them have moved with their families
This is more likely for the Polish migrants in the UK or in Germany versus the Ukrainian migrants in Poland. Ukrainians in Poland don't have as secure rights to migration and work. So the labor mobility is much more restricted, and that restricts their ability and willingness to travel to Poland without any kind of prospect of a long-term potentially stay. Some of them have adult children and have moved abroad to support their already grown up children and grandchildren. So there is a lot of family support happening through this, and it was excluded just because of time.
We're reaching 1:30, so if there's any other very quick question, Chico.
Chico Ferreira from the III. Thank you, Anya. Have you done any work with non-white immigrants into Western Europe, and are there differences in the patterns?
I think a lot of these differences by non-white, so from different contexts.
Africans, Indians.
Right. Yes. No, I haven't, but I would expect that both the. So one of the reasons why there is such a high number of Ukrainian migrants in Poland is that Poland has been very selective in who it accepts amongst society. It is largely currently driven by the Polish state, by the Polish government. And so the very selective migration process, the unwillingness to accept Syrian refugees during the 2015 and the aftermath of that was quite strong. And Poland's rationale was, well, we already accept migrants from Ukraine, which is a completely different story with Polish migration and instrumentalizing this. So I haven't worked on this, but the experiences would be very different, also because of the structural and policy environment that shapes that.
And just to follow up, like you have the Asian caring body as a very very symbolic of the care sector, and I'm wondering whether those perceptions are equally growing with Polish.
You have the warm, family-oriented, right, giving nurse that will just fix everything for you for free.
Mary Poppins. All right. On that note, let's end here, and let's give Anya... it's really been a pleasure. Okay.
Is it what I say?